Good morning, everybody, and thank you for joining us here today. My name's Howard Watson. I'm the BT Group Chief Technology and Information Officer, and welcome to what is the fourth business briefing that we've been doing in this new format. What I intend to do today, because you don't usually see an update from technology at our quarterly results. We are a part of BT that is recharged across to the customer-facing unit, so you see us in there. What we're going to attempt to do today is lift the veil on technology and give you a much deeper insight into some of the unique capabilities that we have in terms of being able to drive forward the future of BT. And that future really is in a world now where we're very focused on 4G becoming 5G, copper migrating to fiber, and MPLS networks through cloud connectivity moving to software-defined wide area networks. So our agenda for today is I'm going to talk a little bit about the market context and then talk about how we look at our technology landscape right now, particularly through the lens of convergence. I'm joined by most of my team today, so Greg McCall will then talk about how we, today and in the future, take some of these opportunities and bring them to life through delivering a differentiated customer experience. Rachel Higham, who runs IT, is then going to talk about our IT transformation journey, something which significantly underpins transformation that we talk about on a quarterly basis with you. John Bezic will then talk about the finances and the transformation program that we're running here in technology. And then I'll come back on to talk a little bit about the opportunities that we create for the future through research. I'm also joined by Neil McCrae in the room, who is our chief architect, Tim Whitley, who runs research at Adastral Park, and Mark Murphy, who runs HR for technology. So we'll have a full Q&A. At the end of the presentation, and myself and the team will take you answer whatever questions you have at that point. So here sort of shows how we fit in to the whole sort of BT family, and really technology is at the heart of BT. We develop the technology that create what we call service platforms that allow our customer-facing units to develop and deliver services to their customers. We architect, design, build, and run all of the networks, with the exception, of course, of the fixed access network in Openreach. We, again, architect, design, develop, and run all of the IT, including on a supplier basis, Openreach's IT. And we run the research for BT Group based out of Adastral Park. You can see essentially my numbers in both operating costs and capex here. All of that, as I said earlier, is recharged through each of our customer-facing units for effectively for segment reporting. This chart needs no reminder. We show you this frequently, but we are a key enabler of the BT strategy, clearly in driving forward the best converged network, but also creating brilliant services that our customer-facing units can then deliver to customers with a truly differentiated customer experience. And through the work that we're doing in both network and IT transformation, we are a significant part of delivering on the simplified, lean, and agile business. Now, really, the key messages today in terms of how we in technology are building a better BT for the future, summarized on this slide. I think we are now entering a new era in the telecommunications industry where the markets are changing ever more rapidly as our customers connect more and more devices to their access networks and are consuming an exponentially increasing amount of data. We have to deliver that a unique set of both core and access networks and as recently a testament with our 5G launch, a proven track record of delivery in terms of bringing those networks and those capabilities to customers. Now, our plans going forward are to take those access networks combined with the IT capabilities and create a single smart network for our customers, which will truly enable continued differentiation in the market and something we alone in the UK are uniquely placed to deliver. We also see opportunities that extend beyond connectivity. And increasingly, we're doing work looking at the security space and how we would think about creating trust as a service. We have a lot of data generated by our customers and by devices, and how we create actionable insight for our customers and for ourselves through, you know, ever more sophisticated analytics we see as a critical enabler for the future, and using that for our enterprise customers to allow them to really tackle, as part of Industry 4.0, productivity, and us being a key enabler in that, we see as an important future technology opportunity. So just looking now at the market context. This is an Ofcom chart. It's fair to say that 10 years ago, you know, we, and I've been in the telecoms industry now for 35 years, but if I go back 10 years, I guess we were coming out of the dual play wave of telephony and TV. I was in the cable industry at the time then, and you know, at that point, you know, a couple of things happened in terms of driving forward broadband. Which I think over the last 10 years has been the sort of growth wave in the telecoms industry. Fixed networks were, you know, moved towards super fast, both at BT and at Virgin Media in the UK, and there was growth there as customers migrated from copper broadband to super fast broadband. And at the same time, but in our case at BT separately, EE were leading the way in terms of driving smartphone adoption on the back of the ability to create good mobile data capability through 4G. However, what we see a decade later is, you know, approaching saturation in those markets. And I think the next wave, the next decade, is fundamentally about how we take those alternative means of accessing data to your device, converge them together, and create a sort of unique, great experience out of that for our customers. Now, it's fair to say that throughout that period, as you're more familiar than I am, this has happened. And so, you know, the challenge of extracting a greater share of wallet from customers for telecommunication services, you know, we're very aware of the implications of this. And therefore spend a lot of time about how technology can help in terms of transforming that trajectory for the future. Now, the paradox, of course, is I actually see the business through this lens, which is what I said at the beginning, an exponential increase in the usage by our customers. Now, historically, we have done a fantastic job, and we will continue to do it into the future in terms of using generations of technology, particularly in the core network, to take what is essentially at the moment a peak of 13 terabits per second on the left-hand chart here, taking that exponential growth through advances in technology, converting it into a linear curve, so it's effectively we're spending the same amount on growing our network roughly each year in terms of CapEx and capital expenditure. So that means we're continually focused on driving down the cost of adding the next incremental gigabit per second to our networks to accommodate that growth. The other key aspect of this chart is if you look at the right-hand chart, we see the same growth trajectory happening on mobile, but currently at about 1/80th of the scale of fixed. So 13 terabits per second is my sort of peak Tuesday evening when we have Champions League coinciding with a download of the latest Fortnite game, shields, weapons, and layers. 13 terabits per second that can generate. The peak in mobile, which was the Champions League final, was 560 gigabits per second. So one of the things that we think hard about is how do we ensure that as growth occurs in mobile, we can apply the scale of fixed in order to accommodate that growth in a really economic cost manner. And that, again, is a unique capability that we have by having both a fixed core and the ability to converge the mobile core into that. So moving on to convergence. So today, as you know, we have three different networks. And the future, though, is about how we take those three networks of superfast broadband moving to ultrafast, mobile moving from 4G to 5G, and Wi-Fi ultimately moving from AC to AX, or Wi-Fi 6, as they cleverly decided to call it, from a public Wi-Fi perspective. How we take those three separate means of customers accessing the network and create a intelligence layer around that that will allow us to truly differentiate through customer experience is a great opportunity that's unique to ourselves, and one that in a second I'll talk about how we're starting to embrace that and deliver capability for our customers. You know, we think, and customer research tells us, that there is real advantage and opportunity in seamless connectivity. You know, not having to continually think about how your device is best configured for what's available to you, whether it's Wi-Fi at home on your superfast or ultrafast network, mobile, or public Wi-Fi. So that software-driven intelligence layer around those three networks, creating one smart network, is the key opportunity that we uniquely have in the UK for the future. Looking at the journey towards that, one of the things that we are industry leading on, not just in the UK, but across Europe, is actually driving customers to spend significantly more time when on the move on 4G. So we're at 98% of our customers now in the use of their phones or smartphones for movement, when moving, on our 4G network. And clearly, as you know, on the 30th of last month, we switched on the UK's first and only 5G network. You know, and again, that continues to ensure that we have the right amount of capacity in the right place for our customers who are on the move. But the convergence story goes beyond that. If you look at the lower part of this chart, pretty much immediately on acquiring EE, we converged ourselves onto a common IMS platform for voice and advanced voice services, so IP voice services, for both BT fixed and EE mobile customers, and BT mobile customers. So voice over Wi-Fi, which is now available across EE and BT mobile, that is the same platform that we'll use and are now starting to use as we migrate customers off the fixed voice network onto an IP voice network, giving us a great opportunity for convergence in voice. And, you know, what's really interesting, if you look at voice, 5-6 years ago, we may have thought voice was in decline, and fixed minutes clearly have been in decline. But if you look now at how we are interacting with devices, I think we're seeing a resurgence of voice, particularly with devices in the home that we use as part of our everyday lives. So the journey of convergence towards this smart network continues here. We'll upgrade our Wi-Fi networks so that we can have a seamless experience, as I've already mentioned. And then a key piece of it, which I'll come to talk to in a second, is a single converged core network that truly enables this seamless connectivity for our customers. And then importantly, we will continue to ensure that we're using our spectrum in the most effective part of the network. So we've done a lot of work on refarming from 2G, 3G into 4G, and in the future we see refarming from 4G to 5G. So I've just mentioned, 30th of May, we launched the first 5G network in the UK. Fantastic initial results of that. You know, we had a number of journalists wandering around the six cities doing speed tests and getting really encouraging results. The key thing to remember here is this is 5G supplementing the capacity that you get on 4G. So when you've got your OnePlus 5G handset here, it's looking at and using a single 5G carrier, 40 megahertz of bandwidth in the 3.4 gigahertz band that we acquired in the auction last year. But at the same time, it's combining that capacity with at least three frequencies from our 4G network, and in some cases four, and in some cases five. And that's where we're confident that we will get a significant speed uplift. 150 megabits per second is what we are conservatively saying to customers as an expectation, from the 30 megabits per second average that we see on 4G today. A really important piece that we decided to do was to ensure that all of our 5G sites are connected with 10 gigabit per second backhaul. So we wanted to ensure that there was, very minimal risk of backhaul contention in terms of, ensuring that we fully utilize the spectrum asset in delivering great capability to customers. And so, we've talked about the six cities we're in now. We talked about, and we're building the network now for the 16 cities by the end of the calendar year. And that's now well and truly in its rollout phase there. Moving on to spectrum assets, I'm comfortable that we have a great spectrum holding both for now and for the future, with 295 megahertz of aggregate sub 6 gigahertz spectrum. We have the largest holding in the UK. And actually, if you look at the sort of sweet spot for 4G, we use 95 megahertz paired of 4G spectrum. That's certainly, it's not the largest, it's one of the largest in Europe in terms of the ability to deliver great speed to customers when it's demanded. We do absolutely intend to be active participants in the upcoming 700 megahertz, 3.6 gigahertz auction, which will happen maybe in just slightly less than a year's time. And that gives opportunities to expand on our 5G spectrum, but also 700 megahertz being quite attractive for enhancing indoor coverage. As I mentioned earlier, we've done a lot of work taking the 1800 megahertz 2G spectrum and the 2100 megahertz 3G spectrum and refarming the majority of that for 4G use. That will continue. We're looking now at the date that we would switch 3G off and therefore be able to reutilize all of the 2100 megahertz spectrum. And thinking about the migration activity we'll need to take customers through in doing that. If we move to the performance of the network, we're proud of the fact that RootMetrics, for the fifth year running, awarded the EE network the best network across all measures. And we continue to be proud of that. P3, also, who do independent benchmarking. Again, if you look at the report they published back in December, had our network way ahead of our competitors here in the UK. Two factors of that. One is geographic coverage. So we're at 85% coverage of the landmass of the UK on the new measures defined by Ofcom. The closest rival to us is 5 percentage points below that. But then if you look at how customers are using it, I mentioned earlier about driving time on 4G, and you can see on the left-hand side how we've been increasing that across our customer base. And then importantly, in terms of how customers are creating benefit from that, what you can see on the right-hand side here is the lower chart is the increase in weekly usage of data by our customers, and the top line, the red line, is their average speed performance. So you can see that for investing in capacity in the network, we've created a stepwise increase in average speed, despite the fact that usage is continuing to grow from our customers. As we move to 5G, 5G is four times today deployed right now in our network, is four times more efficient on a sort of bits per megahertz basis of delivering data than 4G. And we think that is very much the start of the journey, combining massive MIMO with selective densification through small cells and the use of millimeter wave, will, I believe, considerably allow us to stay ahead and, in fact, sort of help stimulate demand from customers for ever greater speed. And just back to this chart, 750 megahertz we have of millimeter wave spectrum in the 32 gigahertz band. Currently today used for point-to-point microwave links, but quite easily repointed for use for millimeter wave in the future. Finally, on the sort of access network, the investment we've been doing through the ESN contract has really allowed us to focus geographic coverage on major and minor roads, and we think that's a great advantage when looking at how IoT use cases expand over the coming years. Moving now to the what is truly the engine room of the network, being at the heart of BT, and that is the core network. So today, it is right to say that essentially we have two cores carrying the voice and data traffic of our customers. What this diagram shows you is the access means in red on the left, through backhaul, which is today provided by OpenReach, and then through MBNL, also by some third-party networks. For mobile, that goes into a mobile IP core, and clearly for fixed, into a fixed core there. Despite the fact that these networks look quite similar on this diagram, there are some quite significant differences. So over the last 7 or 8 years, on the fixed network, we have invested in pushing functionality around authenticating customers and therefore determining what speed allowance they're allowed or they've bought right out to the edge of the network. That means that the network is very economic at adding the next megabit per second or 100 megabit per second as demand increases. All mobile standalone networks today on the planet, might be a brave statement, but I'll say it anyway, they trombone all of the traffic into the center, letting these HLR, HLSs work out what that customer is entitled to, and it then goes back out to the edge to work out what speed you can have over your radio access network. That is very effective for helping you work out how you hand over between mobile cell sites as you're moving around the country. It's challenging when it comes to adding extra capacity into a mobile network to accommodate growth. So four times is the premium in the core network that it currently costs to add an extra megabit per second of capacity compared to the fixed network. The unique opportunity we have in having both of these is to essentially do what that looks like and effectively, keep the control plane capability for mobile centralized in a few number of devices, but push the traffic management of mobile out to the edge and benefit from that fixed economics that we have as we see mobile demand grow. That allows us to be thinking in a much less constrained way about how we grow traffic on the mobile network. Some other key things here. The previous chart, a lot of suppliers in that space, so we have a big transformation opportunity as we move from that previous chart with the two core networks to a single core network here. That's also the point at which we'll remove Huawei from the EE core. I'm sure there'll be a question on that later. But also importantly, this gives us the opportunity to have true seamless switching between access networks without the customers having to do something to enable that, best switching depending upon what access network you have available with what capability at any one time. Now, that's how we sort of, you can look at that and say, we're replumbing the core network, which is true. But the other key piece of it, which is the network cloud box, as you'll see here, is we are completely revolutionizing how we build core networks, and I'll talk about that in a second. But I think it's quite important to just look at that core network, what I believe is truly the engine room of the network, and look at how it's performing. This is Ofcom's annually produced, and it was produced back in May, data which looks at home broadband performance. And what I always look for in there, because it's what relates to your core network, is what is the probability of on that Tuesday evening when Champions League and Fortnite downloads are happening at the same time, what is the probability that you will see the same sort of speed that you would have seen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the network's quiet? And that's what these two charts show, because we believe it's critically important that our customers get the speed that they expect when they most need it. The left-hand chart here is super fast. What this shows, as you get to the right-hand side here, this is the percentile of customers that are still achieving the speed that they get in quiet times. You can see our FTTP super fast product unaffected almost until you get to 98% percentile in terms of peak usage. And likewise, looking at the other BT products, the bottom lines there are Sky and TalkTalk. On the right-hand side, that's what happens in ultra-fast. So this is the BT 145 meg and 300 meg FTTP products compared to the Virgin Media 200 and 350 megabit per second products. This is showing the Achilles heel of cable. I know it well, so I was there for 16 years. The Achilles heel of cable, which is hybrid fiber coax networks and a shared access infrastructure, which means even with DOCSIS 3 and DOCSIS 3.1, it's very difficult in the evening to provide a good peak time performance similar to what customers enjoy during the day. I mentioned network cloud. This is truly transforming how we build and use our core networks. The left-hand side of this picture shows what we have today. In essence, appliances in the core network, usually bought from the supplier with proprietary compute technology or hardware embedded into their application. Yes, there's been some virtualization in that space, but really what the technology now enables is cloudification of that. This is taking public cloud, sort of cloud scale type capability, taking that technology, putting it in our critical buildings, really close to the network, but allowing then the applications to be containerized into this network cloud rather than built with specific network appliances. Yes, there's a cost saving from that, and a significant one going forward, but the big advantage of it is the ability to add new services and new components in the core, will now in the future be in weeks rather than months. Because today when we add a new box into the core, that is a long-term introduction and migration problem that we tackle within the networks organization. So, you'll have heard companies like Rakuten talk about this. That technology, we've now got deployed in one node. You've seen recently we announced deals with Cloudera, Cisco, and Juniper to build this capability, and this will form the fundamental of our 5G core, which will be the first use of this, and then continued rollout beyond that. So these multiple technologies are coming together. It's allowing us to create this new, unique capability compared to our competitors in the UK of truly bringing mobile and fixed together to create this smart network with the intelligence layer and allow us to create consistent experience, seamless handover, all fully protected for our customers. So to bring that to life a little bit, I'm going to hand over to Greg, who's going to talk about differentiated customer experiences. Greg.
Thanks, Alan. Morning, everyone. My name's Greg McCorn. I probably have the best job in the UK because I run a team of brilliant, talented engineers that design, build, and operate all the services that our customers enjoy and use every single day. During the session today, I'm going to take you through our latest thinking on what we're doing around convergence And coupled with that, I'm also going to talk about what we're doing in our mobile network to ensure that we keep our mobile network at the forefront and the best mobile network that our customers can use and benefit from. But firstly, I'd like to show you a short video that really brings our latest thinking on convergence to life. So if you could roll the video, please.
The converged network is coming. And though you won't see it, it will revolutionize the digitally connected world. Connecting the things we rely on so they're always alert, keeping us safe. Connecting our homes and offices for our convenience and comfort, whilst helping manage our world's resources. And connecting with us for little things, like managing our time. And big things, like monitoring our health. With the converged network, we'll move from place to place without a second thought on how our devices connect, but often stay in the same place, using technologies like virtual or mixed reality to transform how we work. Connecting will be simple and automatic, opening up the digital world to everyone, no expertise necessary. With new solutions to old problems, making it easier to keep track. And whilst it won't keep track of everything, it will mean faster solutions, with new ways of shopping and paying. It will transform how businesses operate through things like 5G managed airspace. It will even bring refinements to things which are already great. And it will mean we can always connect when we want to talk, watch, or play. Our devices seamlessly connecting and handing off one to the next. Giving more time for us to connect with each other. A safe and secure converged network we can trust. Built for the future by the name we trust.
I hope you agree that the future of convergence is going to be super exciting. And here at BT, we believe that we are the only company that can really bring this to life in the UK. Some of what you saw in the video is actually going to be available very soon. Some of it's a bit further down the line. But what I can assure you is that across our smart single network, we will bring convergence to life for the UK public. So what you'll see on this diagram here is a use case that many of you will be very familiar with. As you know, we have the biggest fibre network. We have more Wi-Fi hotspots than anyone else in the UK. And by every measure, we've led the UK mobile industry. So we want to continue this trend. And one of the things that you will see is the area of high usage that we haven't really focused on is the commuter services that our customers use. It's been poorly served in the UK by all operators, and this is something that we are going to start focusing on very, very heavily. We want to converge, and we want to bring our mobile assets together. We want to invest heavily in that around the commuter areas, and we also want to bring our Wi-Fi hotspots together to ensure that we can service a really seamless experience for our customers whilst they're on the move. By combining both mobile and Wi-Fi, we believe that customers will be able to stay connected when they're out and about, and we believe that drop calls and interrupted streaming on BT Sport will become a thing of the past. The Wi-Fi networks are something that we've underinvested in the past, but it's something we are really, really focused on ensuring that that, coupled with our mobile network, can deliver that promise. So I think it's quite obvious that convergence for customers on the move is a use case that we can all relate to. But convergence is also very, very important for our enterprise customers. Many of our enterprise customers are 100% dependent on network connectivity every single day, doing very menial tasks within their business, like fulfilling online orders, making or taking payments, managing their stock, or even simple things like answering phone, their customer queries over the phone. But even though our fixed network has very, very good availability, it's impossible for us to guarantee 100% uptime because we don't control what people do out in the street. And if someone digs up a street and cuts through the fiber line, that interrupts the service. And as you can imagine, depending on the severity of that damage, that could mean the service is down for days and if not weeks for some of our business customers. And this is where, by combining our mobile and our fixed networks together, it's a real game changer for our customers. Many of our SME customers have already signed up to the 4G Assure product that Howard spoke about. And this allows that when the fixed network goes down, the router will automatically switch across the mobile network and our customers will be able to continue their business activities uninterrupted. Later this year, not only will our consumer customers benefit from this resilience, but we'll also be bringing a service to both our consumer customers and our enterprise customers that allows us to bond the fixed and mobile networks together, not only to provide much better resilience, but also to boost the fixed network. We think this is going to be a game changer for both our enterprise and our business customers going forward. So the best of mobile and the best of fixed will come together, not only to deliver the most resilient product that we've ever delivered, but will also allow our customers to boost their broadband service. So EE, you will remember, in 2012, was the first mobile operator to bring 4G to the UK. When 4G was launched, I think it was not very clear for any of us of exactly how customers or how businesses were going to develop services that really take advantage of that brilliant network. But fast forward 7 years, and could any of you imagine a life where you don't have the ability to order a taxi within minutes, you couldn't order your food from anywhere in the country, or something that's quite close to my heart, be able to watch live sport or TV, even where there isn't TV. That is what 4G enabled, and it's something that we are very excited about what 5G might enable. It's fair to say that no one is sitting here with an absolute crystal ball that can say exactly what 5G is going to enable. But what we are absolutely confident about is that there are many use cases that can't be served by the 4G network, and 5G is built to ensure that it's got the extra resilience, it's got ultra-low latency, and it's got speeds that, you know, Howard demonstrated a little bit earlier. By being the first operator in the UK to launch 5G, and by being the only operator, lots of companies have already started to collaborate with us about the kind of services they can bring to life for customers, and we're excited about the opportunity that's going to create. By launching 5G only weeks after it was first launched in South Korea, we have taken the UK from laggard to leader, and by having the best mobile network, by adding 5G to that, we believe our network is going to continue to get better. 5G is going to enable smart cities, smart campuses, and many MCOMS use cases. And here at BT, we are well placed to monetize that. So on this slide, many of you would have heard of the gaming company from the US, a company called Niantic. They were responsible for bringing Pokemon Go to the world, a very popular game that really got people out of their lounges and using games, and it was a very social game. You saw weird people running around the streets doing weird things all the time. Well, only last week, they have launched their next game, which is Harry Potter Wizards Unite. I've had the pleasure of seeing what this game is going to do, and let me tell you, it's going to be super exciting, not only for our kids, but it's going to be super exciting for adults as well. Niantic have chosen to partner exclusively with us here at EE, to ensure that they can bring that game to life. They've done that because we have a proven track record of innovating, we have a proven track record of delivering the best network, and we are the only network in the UK that has 5G. The great thing about this game is it brings the virtual world and the real world into one, and customers will be running around the country and even running into our stores because our stores feature in this game. We're super excited about it. It launched last week. As I say, Niantic have chosen to exclusively partner with us, and we're excited about what opportunities that's going to bring. The reason why these kind of games are going to work a lot better on 5G than on 4G is because they bring significant scale, they rely on real resilience, and 5G is designed and built for those kind of use cases. As you can imagine, where you've got 500-600 gamers all converging in a tiny area in the UK, on the 4G network you might slow down, whereas on the 5G network you'll be able to continue the game and kill people or do whatever you might want to do in the game. So the second image is another use case that I'm super excited about. It's something that we did last week. It was a trial that we did with the NHS at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. So in the presence of the Mayor of West Midlands, Andy Street, we did a medical trial where we were doing remote ultrasound over the 5G network basically demonstrating how that works as though you are in the same room as the patient. And the great thing about this is it's another one of those things that we've brought to life. It's one of the first medical trials that we've done over a live 5G network. And once again, it's a first for Europe. So we're leading the way in that as well. And finally, on the right-hand side, you would have heard about our extended sponsorship of Wembley. Wembley is a great showcase for us to bring to life what the capability of a 5G network is. We've all been at sports stadiums trying to use our phones when there are lots of people, and it's near impossible even to get an SMS out, never mind be able to surf the internet or watch on your VR headset. We're doing a lot of innovation with a lot of companies to use Wembley as a testbed to really bring that to life. I think one of the things that we should all be quite excited about is the experience of in the stadium and out the stadium has always been very different. We believe that by bringing our 5G network to life, you'll be able to get the brilliance of broadcast in the stadium, but equally the excitement of being in the stadium, out the stadium. And hopefully this next video will really bring that to life. But before I click on the video, one of the things that we are also very excited about is this weekend, for those of you who are going to the music festival in Glastonbury, you will be able to experience in real life what a 5G network will deliver there. So we've got quite a lot of people showcasing our capability there, and we're excited about what that will bring. So let me play you a short video. This is a live video of people, real customers, using our 5G network.
Take a picture of me?
For the 138th
Cup
final.
What is that,
man? That's Wembley right now.
Do you know what that is?
Oh, where am I?
You're at Wembley Stadium. Hi, young man, you see me?
Okay, yeah. Yes.
John. At Wembley.
Good luck with that.
All right.
Well, come on, move it.
Swear you were there. This is 5G, now on the UK's number one network.
As I say, I've got the best job in the UK because I get to play with those things all the time and bring those things to life and then see those kind of experiences that our customers enjoy every single day. But to bring our next bit of excitement to you, I'm going to welcome Rachel on stage who will take you through our IP transformation.
Thank you, Greg, and good morning, everyone. I think actually I have a joint best job with Greg because I'm going to be leading one of the UK's largest and most ambitious IT transformations over the next few years. You've heard us talk about cost transformation a lot during our annual results presentations, and as technology, we have a lot to do to help the business simplify and automate their processes and create those new products that will generate new revenue for us. The largest part of that effort sits within IT, so that's why we're going to share a little bit about our IT transformation journey today. Our IT transformation is a whole-scale transformation of everything we do, from how we're going to rationalize and modernize our legacy platforms, to how we're going to digitize our business and deliver code into live environments. During our most recent annual results presentation, we shared the chart on the left there To give you a view of how complex our broadband provisioning process is, and that's just a glimpse at the overall complexity in our IT estate today. We've built our IT estate over the last 30 years predominantly in silos to deliver our different market segments, and then we've added to that through acquisition. As a result, our total cost of ownership is too high, our processes are too complex and manual, customer experience has been negatively impacted due to delays in fulfilling requests and getting real-time information, our lead times for products and services are just too long, and it's difficult to find and collaborate on the data which exists in little pockets all over our organisation. To solve these issues, we have to move from the rigid IT estate we have today to an adaptive and modular IT ecosystem that allows us to deliver both a step change in customer experience and a dramatic improvement in the time it takes us to respond to business needs. And this has to be done in lockstep with simplifying our products, our processes, and our network. It's no good just simply moving today's complexity into a digital native architecture. We're embarking on a massive business simplification program across the business, which will lead to improved customer experience, efficiency savings, and better employee engagement as we improve the world for our colleagues too. Over the last year, we've been defining the new building blocks of our future IT ecosystem and getting clear on where we'll deploy the latest emerging technologies and engineering practices to deliver those outcomes. We've worked closely with our business colleagues to map the strategic ambition, the current pain points and operational and customer needs, and we've translated that input into five-year roadmaps to not just simplify our business, but to deliver enhanced and new capabilities too. Some of the areas we're going to be focusing on for those new capabilities are around customer management, agent knowledge management, product management and development, and partner onboarding. We're currently mobilising a series of lighthouse projects in those spaces to prove that our new approach to building IT will enable that step change in customer and colleague experience, but also that we can build single capabilities that will serve multiple business units. Over the next two slides, I'll talk a little bit about what those new building blocks are. Let's start with cloud. Increasingly, we will innovate, test, and scale our on-premise IT infrastructure with off-premise public cloud solutions. We're already using Pivotal together with Amazon Web Services to provide our engineering teams an environment in 2 minutes. That's something that used to take up to 16 weeks, so a massive improvement in productivity. We're migrating many of our applications to the cloud and seeing huge performance benefits as they self-heal and self-scale. A great example is in Greg's world, where we're using Amazon to scale our BTTV infrastructure as we cope with the peak demands from Champions League events, for example. Microservices and API-enabled platforms are vital in a digital world to deliver modular plug-in IT, reuse, and faster partner onboarding. The new services we're launching on our BTTV platform very soon, in Now TV, Amazon Prime, and Harry Potter's Wizards Unite, have all been enabled by our API platforms. We've been able to engage with a much broader set of major providers, onboard them much faster, and ensure the experience for our customers across them is exactly the same. Our new Enjoy service that helps Londoners get and set up their new EE phone faster was also enabled and delivered in half the time by our API platform. And we're driving reuse too. All of the APIs we delivered for our call center agent platform have been reused to create the MyBT app to allow our customers to choose to self-serve if they want to. Becoming digital demands brand new ways of working to realise the full benefits, and so we're investing heavily in design thinking, agile, DevOps practices across the organisation. We're using design thinking to become more human-centred and to conduct deep research into the pain points our customer experience and co-create brilliant new customer journeys with them and our teams. We recently launched PlusNet's first ever mobile app using those techniques, and because we use design thinking to create a fantastic customer experience, it had one of the fastest download rates of any of our apps and is now the highest rated non-EE app on the Apple Store. In our wholesale IT team, we've managed to double the productivity of our development teams by having them work in agile ways and adopt new tooling. to automate and instrument much of what they do. Adopting these practices across our entire organisation is a huge multi-year effort, but we're already making great progress. We've trained 4,500 people on design thinking, putting that human centredness into the team, and this year, financial year, we will deliver 20% of all of our demand in an agile way. As we move forward, we will only build out of absolute necessity. Otherwise, we'll be using the as-a-service market capabilities and the best of those. This will allow us to move forward far more rapidly, drive standardisation across the business, and focus our own internal development on differentiating customer experience. We've recently rolled out the Salesforce mobile app rapidly across our global and our enterprise sales teams with the aim to increase productivity, standardising practice, allowing agents to also collaborate globally across their teams. Since January, we've seen productivity gains of 240 hours per salesperson, and our enterprise team estimate they've achieved a 10% additional conversion rate by having their agency able to connect across the world. We're also consolidating all of our consumer billing onto Brightbill, which reimagines the billing experience for our customers across the BC, CE brands, and also eliminates one of the biggest detractors we have. And again, the speed at which we can do that is revolutionary. If we look at automation, we've brought human-centered design together with robotic process automation to make sure we get the human-machine interaction right and that we carefully consider the impact on our people and our customers as we do that. We've now got 168 robots live across the company, saving our people 180,000 hours of really dull, manual, repetitive work. Now we've got the platform and the skills in place in the business, we estimate we'll be saving millions of hours of dull work across the organisation over the next couple of years. One great example is where our agents have to call out to a customer to verify a fault has been fixed before they can close down their tickets. That takes multiple attempts. Now we've fully automated that, saving 5,000 calls a week for our team. Artificial intelligence and machine learning will be leveraged in our customer and employee experiences, our network, and our operations as we go forward to allow us to become more proactive and responsive. We've recently launched Eva, our first ever communication provider facing conversational chatbot. If you're an OpenReach agent or working for one of our communication provider customers, you can have a conversation with Eva to check on the status of orders, manage and cancel those. 30% of all our agent interactions have moved over to Eva in the last 6 months, which is extraordinary. We're taking 40% less time to resolve issues as a result. We want to double those measures over the next 18 months. But our overarching philosophy in BT is to use AI and machine learning to augment our people, to remove dull and repetitive tasks and take the robots out of the human. Finally, data is at the heart of everything we do. Exceptional customer experience relies on a combination of great products, efficient processes, and increasingly great data analytics. We're in the business of selling experiences now that rely heavily on real-time accurate data. So we're focusing on bringing together those silos of data into a single place and then overlaying AI to be able to spot patterns and allow us to be more proactive for our customers. A great example is where we recently brought together weather data with our broadband fault data to help us predict the impact of lightning strikes and floods ahead of time. What we've been able to do is build more resiliency in ahead of time and actually push our engineers out into the field where we think the impact will be, ready to go and solve those issues. By doing that, we've reduced our broadband fault levels by 2.5%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's 400,000 people and homes and businesses that are no longer having weather-related broadband problems. Now, many IT transformations of this kind of scale fail because they forget to take a holistic approach to change, and they forget to think carefully about the impact on people and their organisation. So to deliver our transformation, we're focusing as much on our organisation, culture, mindset and ways of working and how they need to change as we are on evolving our system estate. During the last 18 months, we've reshaped and invested heavily in leadership, culture and mindset. We're building a growth mindset, encouraging curiosity, innovation and fostering collaboration, and empowering our people to learn and grow. We've also invested in new centres of excellence around those emerging technologies, so we have the skills in the business to take us forward. And we're making IT simpler to work with for our business colleagues too. We're reimagining every single touch point with the business by using design thinking to truly understand how our customers want to work with us and making that effort. Finally, under strong partnerships, we've recontracted with all of our subcontractor suppliers to make sure they're transforming in step with us and that we have the right mechanisms in place to get the best out of them at the right cost point. And that alone has saved us between 25 and 40% of our external labour costs on an ongoing basis. Many of these shifts need a different set of skills across the whole business. So we're not just reskilling IT as we do this, we're actually reskilling the whole of DT. We're embedding these five skills on the left here across each business unit and building out new centres of excellence to lead the way. We're on track to retrain around 20,000 people across the organisation. To achieve that scale, we've had to create and design innovative new training experiences, gamifying the learning experience, and have recently won two industry awards, beating many gaming companies through those. We've increased the amount of external speaking we're doing to build our brand credibility as being a great place to work for people with these skills, something that wasn't true in the past. And we've done a lot of disruptive hiring to bring the skills into the organisation and the experience of doing this at scale previously. We're 18 months into what we think is about a 5 to 6 year journey, but we're making really great progress. We've reskilled 4,500 of an eventual 20,000 people in our business. We've banked $195 million already, annualised saving off our total cost of ownership of IT. Our team engagement measures are on a great upward trajectory, which is really important for retaining and attracting talent. And we know that human-centeredness and design thinking are working, as every new service we've launched has a net promoter score of between 43 and 81. Remembering, anything above 10 is great. But to summarise, over the next few years, we're delivering one of the most ambitious IT transformation programmes in the UK. We're doing this in a radically different way by embedding human-centeredness and design thinking into everything we do to deliver brilliant customer and colleague experiences. We're already delivering great outcomes by investing in our people and partnerships to adopt new ways of working, building out new centres of excellence around emerging technologies, and working with our business colleagues to co-create and launch exciting new propositions and experiences for our customers even faster. These outcomes will only grow as we move forward. I now hand over to John, who will talk us through the financials.
Good morning, everybody. I'm John Bezzik, I'm the CFO for Technology. So let me start by setting the context of technology within the group. The chart on the top left shows how we sit within the group's overall financial context. UK operating costs at 1.6 billion sit as part of the group's total 19 billion of operating costs. Capital expenditure at 1.5 billion, that represents 40% of the group's total capital investment portfolio. And overseas operating costs amount to £208 million per annum. So dealing first with UK operating costs, these cost dynamics continue the track record in technology where transformation effects are offsetting the costs associated with business volume growth. These costs in aggregate relate to running and maintaining the network and our systems that support our customers. The UK costs were recently driven by reductions in spectrum annual license fees and also the strategic sourcing savings that Rachel mentioned a moment ago. They've been offset, of course, by the impact of extending our mobile coverage, be that for 4G, be that extending the coverage related to our ESN customer contracts, or also extending our network for 5G. We also see the impact of higher energy costs in our business. Bottom left, the pie chart on the left-hand side, that shows the key elements and proportions of our run cost base. You can see it splits out into a number of areas. I call out MBNL, that's the sharing arrangement between BT and Hutch 3G. You can also see the external costs of running and supporting our UK networks and systems. You can see the cost of energy, a really material part of our cost base. And you can also see the total labour cost of our BT colleagues and the third-party subcontractor partner organisations. Taking a look at CapEx now, this is an area where we purposely continue to reinvest transformation and efficiency savings to build out from the already unique core and access networks that give customers the award-winning network coverage and capacity. As you can see from this second pie chart, a significant proportion of our investment is targeted towards maintaining network leadership, really building out that converged core for the future. Whilst within this, we're also making sure that we're achieving industry-leading cost points to deploy that capacity. We need to ensure that we build out the network where, as Greg articulated earlier, our customers really need it. So how do we get to these industry-leading cost points? That comes from the team within BT working in close relationships with our key network vendors, and that allows us to specify what we need from our network. It also allows us to say, these are the techniques we need to deploy this in the most effective manner. How do we think about that in the context of the segmental reporting that we take out and share with you all? So looking at the left-hand side where we think about our operating costs. Again, this is in the context of the $19 billion of operating costs at the group level. Our methodology for allocating the technology cost base is to, where appropriate, align our recharges to the business units on the same basis as we describe in our regulatory financial statements. For the areas where there isn't a regulated context, what we do is we look at the drivers of those costs and we allocate to the business units based on that cost driver. An example would be around the mobile cost for our consumer businesses, that for consumer, enterprise, and global services. We look at the number of SIMs that we're providing in those different markets. We adjust that based on the bandwidth that's used by each of those customer segments, and we allocate it on the weighted number of SIMs that sit in those different segments. So that's our approach on operating costs. Turning to the CapEx allocation, we can think about this in two areas. First of all, the area with the bound line around the dark blue and the pinkish color on the pie chart. These are the costs associated with building the shared infrastructure that serves all of our customers through consumer, enterprise, and global. We focus most of our investment, of course, on building that shared network. But in addition to that, we also have the capital expenditure that relates to individual customer-facing units. So that could be the development of the PlusNet app that Rachel talked about before. We would hold that specifically in our consumer business. So, of course, the specific business unit developments are capitalized straight onto the balance sheet of that individual segment. And where we have a shared infrastructure, like our core network, we allocate that based on consumption and usage in our core network. I want to look a little deeper at operating costs on slide 39. The chart on the left shows that the recent last year financial dynamics aggregated, of course, on this chart. And you can see that we've had this mobile network growth as we build out our network to serve our customers in capacity and coverage terms. And we've also seen these increased energy costs. What that has been offset by, of course, is the continued focus on our simplification of strategic sourcing. Also, we benefited, as you will all have seen, from the outcome of the discussions on annual license fees. Diving a little more on the energy costs on the right-hand side, you'll see this is one of the areas on my first pie chart, the operating costs earlier on. You'll all be aware of the impacts of energy pricing in pounds per megawatt hour in the UK. That's represented by the red line on the chart on the right-hand side. And over the last few years, you've heard Simon Louth talk through some of our energy reduction initiatives in this area and to tackle the headwinds. One of the key mechanisms in this space has been through the deployment of adiabatic cooling units. Many of you will encounter this when you're on your holiday soon, actually. You'll likely encounter this adiabatic cooling effect. You'll know that moment when you step out of the sea and there's a slight sheen of water on your skin. You feel the breeze moving over that water and you feel cooler. That is the adiabatic cooling effect in action. And we use this same effect deployed in modern cooling units. And we're deploying this, these network elements into our major network nodes. And this has a material impact in the amount of energy that we're using. And we've got an investment case that's running over about 3 years where we're spending tens of millions of pounds in this capability and driving real savings in our energy costs as a result. So an example about how we're managing the growth in the data consumption that Howard talked about earlier on by reducing our unit core costs. This slide 40 shows the real transformation that we've achieved in our capital investment portfolio as we build out and ready ourselves for our One Smart Network. Over the last 2 years, we've been holding our levels of absolute investment quite flat, and we've been reinvesting those transformation savings to allow an increasing proportion of our investment into the network, particularly at this time of exponentially more data. And the chart on the right shows the track record that Howard introduced a little earlier by mitigating the exponential cost, sorry, the exponential usage of data by our customers. The dark blue bars on the right-hand side show the unit cost of adding a gigabit per second of incremental capacity into our fixed network. And since 2012, we've seen a material 16% CAGR reduction to 16-17 in the incremental unit cost of capacity through both the transformation of the network, architected by Neil, and also the delivery track record of our teams who are building these networks. The light blue bar represents the higher unit cost of adding mobile incremental capacity. Again, Howard touched on that earlier. Looking forward, we see this opportunity for further improvement on our journey towards One Smart Network that will allow us to continue to drive efficiency and effectiveness into our investments and make sure we're optimizing our group capital investment as a whole. So just a final slide on our transformation agenda across technology. Slide 41 lays out some broader examples from this transformation program. And we have defined and measurable and in implementation plans in each of our technology units already. And that continues to build on our track record of transformation and engineering delivery. And it's all underpinned by this new operating model that a moment ago Rachel was talking about as a great example in IT. I mentioned a moment ago the work the team are leading around meeting the customer data needs and our plans for a single converged core. I talked about energy as a key focus area, and we're making the investment confidently to drive a real investment that will deliver outcomes to reduce our run costs. On strategic sourcing, you saw earlier the nature of our cost base and our relationship with external organizations. These continued partnerships with these organizations driving innovation, value, and cost savings remains a key focus for us. Similarly, there remains a disproportional cost of running our legacy systems and platforms when compared with their smart network equivalents. And we're running a suite of programs that are all focused on addressing the legacy cost base whilst moving our customers to the next generation services. So in summary, we have a broad transformation program that sits across every part of our technology business. We have a strong track record of delivery to date, and that track record of delivery and the focus and opportunities for simplification, automation, and network optimization make us confident of a robust and continued contribution to the group. Howard.
Thank you, John. Just before we go to questions, the last topic on the agenda is I just want to talk about some of the unique opportunities we have the ability to create through some of the research work that we're doing, remembering that BT is the third largest R&D investor in the UK, and when it comes to the number of inventions that we're filing each year, again, third largest in Europe. And one of the great assets that we have at BT here that many of our telco brethren across the industry don't have. So I just want to bring some of that to life. Look at near-term research that we're doing, that's summarized on here. So quite a bit of research around network cloud that I spoke about earlier, and how we combine research that we're doing with the work that our partners on the vendor supply side are doing allows us to create unique opportunities for ourselves there. You've heard us talk about quantum key distribution before. This is using the quantum properties of light to transmit encryption keys as opposed to the current methodology, which is stick one on a motorbike, put it at the other end, and use public key encryption. The industry expects that as quantum computing ever advances, that current encryption methodologies have only a number of years left. Quantum key distribution solves that paradigm. We think there's a billion-dollar business or billion-pound business in the UK here over the next 10 to 15 years, and there's opportunity for us to play a significant role in that. We're the leading player in the UK here with our partnership with Toshiba. Immersive content, something that we, this is, Greg talked about having one of the most fun jobs. I'll need to keep reminding him of that. One of the reasons that we're able to make that really fun for our customers is the research we do in content and how to make that ever more immersive for our customers. And you'll see with BT Sport, we continue to push the envelope in terms of content experiences. And then the last two here, really about cyber. We have one of the leading cyber capabilities, and all of that comes through research that we do in combining AI capability, machine learning, and human visualization techniques to enable operation centers to effectively detect a cyber event and react to it quickly before it creates any challenges. And then on AI, the recent report from the Patent Office, BT is the largest filer of AI patents from a UK company, so we're ahead of Oxford University, Arm, BAE, Rolls-Royce, in terms of creating AI capabilities. We still do a lot of research on network. I mentioned earlier a 4x improvement we're getting on MIMO today. We believe that will, over the next few years, probably 5, 6, 7 years, there is an order of magnitude, a tenfold improvement on the way in the capability of MIMO, i.e. spatial multiplexing, having the radio waves follow you around rather than broadcasting them out from a base station. So we see a real opportunity there for capacity increases in the network. We continue to look at the fundamentals of physics, particularly in fiber optic cables, and so continuing to ensure that the fiber that we have today in our core networks won't need to be replaced is a critical piece of the research. But also the fiber that we're about to put in and are putting in through Openreach as we build full fiber Britain, the key challenge there is how do you detect blockages and how do you minimize signals? And we're doing research in ground sensing radar using quantum signatures just a few feet below the ground and using robotics, looking at research and using robotics to clear blockages rather than the need to dig holes and incur that expense. And then finally, around the whole instrumentation of network, real opportunities there as the network devices start to stream to us their performance, and then how we build machine learning around that to create an ability of self-healing. So I have one example in a video here, which I think nicely brings some of that capability to life. If we can have the video, please.
Across the globe, we're seeing a dramatic explosion in the number of cyber attacks. It's no longer enough to simply react to these. We must be constantly monitoring and anticipating threats because the stakes are simply too high not to. At BT, we know that staying secure is all about keeping one step ahead. Our network of cybersecurity operations centers around the world brings together world-class security intelligence, horizon scanning, and security analysis to deliver effective and proactive cyber capabilities and services to our customers. We gather terabytes of big data 24/7 from across the globe to identify any threat to customers' security and turn this into actionable intelligence. Our data lake provides the underlying power to identify trends, run heuristics, and correlate information. Incoming events are automatically scanned for matches against complex intrusion patterns for insights into unusual traffic and behaviors, and are then correlated with other internal and external events to identify and alert anomalies. Security controls are continuously updated. Malware is analyzed and quarantined. Threat intelligence is gathered from around the world, and threats are contextualized relative to the organization's policies. Our analysts can drill down into suspicious activity, quickly identify key information, and evaluate, based on their knowledge and experience, whether the threat is of significance. They can also scroll back in time conducting forensic research on what may have been targeted in the past. Deep dive analysis of threats allows our cybersecurity analysts and experts to build up a profile of threats and trends that they can use to further refine the intelligence feed. This continuous learning empowers our global cybersecurity intelligence centers to respond proactively to previously unidentified threats. Threat reports that are generated for specific clients are anonymized and loaded to the information sharing platform, allowing cybersecurity operation centers to collaborate and protect our customers. Rigorous defense is only possible by working together, nationally and internationally.
So there's an example of creating capability for customers, you know, beyond pure connectivity. And I think if I look at the next sort of 10 years of the ecosystem that we, you know, as a communication service provider or telco operate in, you know, the work that we're doing now in technology is allowing us to look at what other opportunities are there. And I showed these four areas earlier. So clearly connectivity and how that converges ever more to create seamless opportunities for customers and experiences is our sort of bread and butter role, albeit with some great unique capabilities given our fixed mobile and core capability. We see trust as being as something where we believe we have a real role to play in the lives of our customers. Also actionable insight and how we create convenience, great experiences and indeed value from that, and then also how we take that capability with algorithms that we're developing through our AI invention portfolio to create productivity capabilities for enterprises and businesses in the UK. So just to summarize from today, four key points here really. We're entering a new era, I think, of telecommunications where the markets are changing rapidly with an explosion of devices and exponentially more data. And secondly, the ability to take the unique core and access assets that I have at my disposal to then create technology around those to build, you know, a brilliant smart network that converges that for customers is a second and third opportunity we have there. 5G is a key part of that. The hybrid hub that will launch later this year, as Greg mentioned, is another significant part. And then finally, the fourth point is the ability to now look at technology which will create an ecosystem available to us beyond pure connectivity in the areas of trust, insight, and productivity, we think are significant opportunities for us for the future. So thank you for that. We're going to reconfigure in about 10 seconds this stage, and then we'll do Q&A. Thank you. Hopefully we'll all fit on here. Yeah, okay. Right, over there. Yeah, please wait for the microphone so it works on the WebEx.
Yeah, morning. Thanks very much for the presentation, Howard and team. That was great. The inevitable Huawei question, if you don't mind, Howard, to kick off. But just could you explain why it's enough, in your view and in BT's view, to separate the core and the edge, please?
Yeah, and
can I just add a second one as well?
Yeah, you can.
Just on the, if the worst came to the worst and the edge was deemed to be off limits as well for Huawei, what's the costs for yourself and for the tech group of replacing those RAN, please, and how much time would that take?
Thanks. Okay, let me tackle the core and edge point first, because I think there is a lot of misconception being talked about this at the moment. I think actually we need to start articulating the network as the core, which I think we all understand, the edge, which is the point at which the intelligence will push out, so multi-axis edge compute. That is still separate from the benign radio access network, which takes radio waves and converts them to ether. And so, you know, our policy, we believe, still stands. We think of it as the edge being an extension of the core rather than something which integrates with the radio access network. So I think it's important to really appreciate that difference because, yes, there's a lot of noise at the moment about core and edge blurring, and so that definition I've just described is true, but that is not the same as core blurring with radio access. We don't see any need to ever do that, and certainly we believe that Huawei continue to have innovation advantage in the ability to convert from one type of medium to another, whether that be from radio waves to Ethernet or from optical to Ethernet. And so over time, that's where, that's with the exception of the 4G core, that's where we restrict their use today. To your second point, there are numerous options that we are looking at and contingency planning for. Now, everywhere we use Huawei in the access network, we have a second source today, whether that's ADSL, VDSL, FTTP, or RAN. And so we are looking at how the balance of supply changes over time there. Let me actually first of all say the 4G, the removal out of the 4G core is already in the MCP, because that was, as you've seen, that was already in the plan. So we've looked at a number of scenarios. I'm not going to give a number at this stage because the number of possible outcomes here is quite mixed, and to attempt to put a number on each of those would be over-challenging.
Thank you. Quick question on the millimeter wave spectrum you talked about for 5G at some point in the future. Could you give us an idea, come up with it on the chart, about when that might be refarmed and what kind of applications within 5G that's most suited to? Because I guess it's probably got quite a low propagation, so it's kind of small cell site, but interested to understand that.
Yeah, and let me give a bit, and then I'll come to Neil to add to that as well. So, that spectrum there, the 32 gigahertz, is ideally in that sort of band 26 to 35, which globally is being looked at for millimeter wave use. I think it's fair to say, as we look at millimeter wave, and particular fixed wireless access, right now today, we still see that as, given the economics of it, relatively niche in its applicability in, say, building the UK's infrastructure. We see opportunities for the 4G variant of it for the USO, for fixed broadband. And we're observing and, looking closely at what Verizon is doing. Now, Neil has really strong relationships with Verizon, so Neil, you could possibly comment on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd see it in three areas, some niche areas in ultra-urban, where we've got kind of some tight buildings, predominantly MDUs. I'd see it actually internally in kind of the factory scenario where you might have a big warehouse, you've got great coverage in that warehouse, and you'd leverage that spectrum for that type of use case. And finally, in some rural use cases, but probably very few. As you know, trying to get a millimeter wave signal through any sort of density is very difficult. But I think right now we continue to trial things, we continue to test things to see how beamforming and other MIMO technologies might help us overcome them. But I think it's useful for us to know that we've got that spectrum holding to, should some big breakthrough happen, we're ready to roll on it and use that spectrum.
Got the back over there.
Thank you. It's James Ratz from New Street Research. So two questions, please. First one is around mobile spectral efficiency. You talked a bit about kind of four times efficiency moving from 4G to 5G. Then you hinted at kind of further efficiencies from massive MIMO and then from ultra MIMO. So what would be great, can you put some numbers around what bits per hertz you're currently able to get across an average cell today on 4G? What that can kind of go to over time and over what range. And then secondly, just interested, maybe it's a question for John on the kind of cost savings as you shut down 2G and shut down copper, sorry, shut down 3G and kind of copper PSTN, what kind of savings do you think you can achieve from that? Thank you.
Okay, so the first one, which essentially was, you know, bits per hertz and how do we see that improve with generations of technology, I'm going to ask Tim to cover. And then we'll come to John on the financial question. Tim.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Howard. It's a really good question. So I guess today we've got, I mean, sort of standard 4G, good performance at a 3 to 3.5 bits per second per hertz. The figures that Howard quoted, it does depend, because the MIMO stuff is about spatial multiplexing, yes? So spatial multiplexing is about differentiating spatial location. That depends on the use case, how dense they are, where, you know, how many handsets in one location, which is why you get this range. So certainly up at the labs, we've seen figures with the sort of technology we have now launched and which we were trying at the labs, which were up at the 20 bits per second per hertz. I think that's a good figure to have in your head from sort of current state of the art in the use case where basically you're trying to differentiate between a mobile handset, roughly 6 foot off the ground, wandering around, which is the mobile use case. If you look to experimentation, we did some work last year with Bristol University, who are one of the leaders in this sort of area globally, and there we achieved what we thought was our world record of around about 117 bits per second per hertz. Now that was, you know, you wouldn't deploy the technology, right? It was rather large. You can look it up on the press. It's very impressive. I'd love to tell you more about it. But that was a sort of hero result. And if you look to the world of research publications, so you go and look at the academic journals, then they're talking in the range of 300 bits per second per hertz. Now, clearly, there is a long way from a launched service to an academic research paper, but does that give you a sense of the scale? And that sort of underpins, I think, the point that Howard was making as to why we are researching and pushing very hard on understanding what the practical engineering art of the possible is from massive MIMO and then ultra MIMO. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's, you know, it does sort of get into the specific use case you have in mind, but potentially yes. But I don't think I'll be persuading Howard to launch it in the next
yeah,
6 months.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, one of our unique capabilities is Tim can set the challenges for us, and Greg and Neil can check that, what do we actually get in practice, and therefore that 4x number, probably a little bit conservative, but I think it's what we feel is the right planning dimension for that. Let me come to the second piece of the question, John.
Okay, James, thank you for the question. I'm going to tackle that using the language of addressing our legacy, or in fact, attacking our legacy. I talked about these plans we have in every single part of our business, and we are thinking a lot around, you know, the generation of products that our customers are using and how we can take those forward. Maybe just to give some color on it, I think there's opportunity through this transformation in the work that our colleagues do in our teams. We can design these new digital journeys. They'll be simpler to operate. They will break less often, and there's an opportunity there. If I think about the energy part, you know, of my pie chart, those old networks are inefficient from an energy perspective. And equally, as we condense our network, there'll be less draw because we'll have a more dense network, if you like, at the core where a lot of that compute takes place. So an energy saving in there. If you think about MBNL, where we're sharing, for the mobile part of your question, we're thinking all of the time about where do we need our access networks and what's the right combination of technologies to serve those customer bases. So I'm not going to give you a precise number on this today. What I would say is we're on it. This is what our transformation program, and when I was talking on these charts around attacking legacy, and I think the dividend comes in a number of places. So that's some color on that.
Okay, we have a question here at the front.
There at some point topic. Couple of questions. One on the training and the workforce. What kind of response are you getting from the workforce? Are they very pleased to be retrained and so on? And will that training, once it finishes, kind of actually have to carry on because of the next things come along, the next processes, next new skills? And the second question is on the energy side and the proposal for the nearly zero carbon footprint for the country by 2050. Are you now looking at that in terms of your own operations and what you need to do?
Rachel, do you want to start with the training point?
Sure. So our people have been delighted and super excited about acquiring these new skills, mainly because we spent 6 months resetting our culture and our mindset and behaviours, and explaining that to be part of one of our brilliant software engineers, you need to adopt that growth mindset, that continuous learning approach. But also, secondly, because we've reimagined the way we want people to acquire knowledge, and we've co-designed with them how they want to learn. So an example on our agile skills, we've created a 10-minute a day, 30-day challenge to give you a agile 101 level of understanding. It's entirely gamified. You compete against your teams and colleagues to acquire that knowledge. So we've made it fun, interactive, in the style our people want to learn, and it's growing exponentially. What's also been interesting is because we've taken that approach, our business colleagues are also taking our new learning experiences as well. So for human-centered design, the majority of that 4,500 number I talked about is actually in the business, not even in technology.
And John, the carbon point?
It's a great point. So the approach to energy reduction is that volume is king. We have to take kilowatt-hour draw out of our networks, and we are doing that. We work all of the time with our group team thinking about the role that we have in the UK. The other thing that we do in technology that plays to this same agenda point is that we think a lot about the tools and the services that our customers can use in wanting to reduce their consumption, about how they go about their business, using our collaboration tools so they can focus on their own reduction as well. So we're very focused on it. We think you can see the degree of that pie chart piece, but it's a big cost for us in the UK, and we think about it in a very holistic way. Our contribution in society, the engineering matters, and as part of this Attack Legacy program as well, it's a very full agenda.
And we are about 1% of the entire UK's energy consumption. So, as John said, it's a responsibility that we take importantly, and have a really good track record of driving down consumption as cost continues to increase in that space. Another question over there, please.
Thank you. It's Mandeep Singh from Redburn. I've got two questions, please. So first of all, I've noticed how you sort of allocate both OPEX and CAPEX costs by business division. Can you give us a little bit more color on how that's done and the process around that? Is that potentially likely to change? I understand there may be some differences between how you present the data there and how it's presented into regulatory reports and accounts. Because right or wrongly, you know, the market values your different business divisions on multiples, and obviously how EBITDA per division looks makes a difference to your so-called sum of the parts. So just a little bit more color around that. That'd be the first question. Second question is, you know, over the decades, you know, we've all visited Astral Park. You do a lot of R&D, as you mentioned, big R&D spender, lots of patents being filed. I mean, why have we never seen something really sexy, high multiple being spun out of BT that's being monetized or IPO'd, or some really, you know, nice, hot technology IPO out of BT? There's something in there that can be externally monetized. Thanks.
Yeah, you tackle the first one.
You're right. So at the Q4 results, Simon talked about a piece of work we're doing where we look at the segmental reporting for the cost, not just technology actually, but right across the group. We will be in the short term, you know, a number of weeks, we'll be bringing out the pro forma position that looks at the reset impacts of that. So do look out for that. And I think, Mark, we're looking within a couple of weeks to be able to bring that, you know, that view. But the principle that I took you through around alignment with the regulatory basis, business drivers, that has a benefit operationally to us as well. The closer the relationship between our team and the customer-facing unit team, so we can work together to understand what are the products and what's the, you know, the real cost to be able to take those to the market and the profits we can enjoy, that's really important. So it's not just internal trading to me. It's about the right relationship between different parts of our business so we can win in the market. We've got the right technology in the market. We need to make sure we've got the right economics. And the transparency that comes from that is a big focus area for us. To Adastral?
I'll cover the Adastral part point. So I think, you mentioned over decades, I think. If you go back and look over decades, you would see actually that in the past we have spun out quite a number of things. I mean, optical is one great example of that. It's fair to say over the last 10 years, we have focused the great research that we do there on, you know, creating capability that we can consume ourselves. You know, probably the largest global impacting one there was how we completely changed the thinking around GFAS and enabled that as an ultra-fast technology from a street cabinet as opposed to something inside a building or from the top of a pole. The other areas where we've been significantly focusing, which this is where this AI capability has come from, is how do we make the productivity up until the day of dispatch in OpenReach be as efficient as possible when you have a set of complex tasks, a complex workforce with multiple skills, and a complex import of activity. We've done a lot of work around that area, which has taken a lot of historic cost out of that problem in OpenReach. You know, if I was to look ahead to the next decade, you, as I was talking in the presentation, you will see us thinking more in the National Park about creating new opportunities for telcos in other, you know, in other adjacent markets. This is creating, this is me agitating from what the technology can do. Don't read into that that, you know, we're definitely committing up particular areas of the business, but around IoT and how you deal with the scale there, we see real opportunities around productivity, particularly in the public sector, and around the whole trust area and using analytics there. Will we get to spinning off additional business out of that? Our model at the moment is to use a dashboard park for 3,000 people in my organization, of which 300 are researchers, and 1,000 partners that we have to innovate Martlesham, which is now 130 companies on that site, so that we can co-create and use there. So that's the focus right now. Yeah, where should we look, Kel?
Thank you. I'm slightly disappointed Mandy didn't manage to use the word unicorn when talking about things there. Three questions from me. Firstly, sorry, Carl from Berenberg. I'd love to hear from Mark in terms of just how you compete for skills. So questions like what does a new grad in Adastral earn? I was just checking on Glassdoor on the West Coast. A fresh-faced graduate can get a six-figure salary. So how do you compete against that? Secondly, I'd love an update on ESN. You're saying in the pie chart that you're spending about $100 million a year on that. In terms of the National Audit Office has said that ESN is unlikely by the target date of 2022. So I just wanted to double check, is BT now getting the revenue to offset at least the costs you're incurring, and are we over the initial CapEx hump to secure your obligations? And then the third thing I'd love to hear, and this is probably a question for Tim, obviously, you know, for the last 3.5 years, your biggest shareholder has been Deutsche Telekom. They're doing a lot of the same stuff as you guys, and can you give some examples of how collaborating together has benefited both of you? Thank you.
Okay, but we'll go through in that order then. Mark.
Yeah, good morning. Morning, Carl. So I think we, our graduates earn less than a six-figure salary, which won't be a surprise to anybody, but we are competing very favourably with the skills and both at a graduate level and at an apprentice level, where we continue to be a significant employer. So we have just over 80 graduates joining us in the technology function in September this year from a variety of disciplines and a good representation across male and female grads as well, which has been noticeably different this year. So I think our graduate offering is strong across the types of skill areas that you heard Greg and Rachel talk about. And we've done some very specific work, and perhaps Tim will touch on this when he has the mic. We've done some very specific work with grads and doctorates coming in to join the research team. So I think we've got to continue to focus on it because it's going to be hotter and hotter, the competition. So we will continue to focus on that. But so far, we're very optimistic about the quality of the graduates that we've continued to be able to bring into the business.
And let me start on ESN, and then I'll pass to Greg, who's in the build for that program. So just so yes, we are beyond the hump now of the build phase of ESN. And secondly, yes, we are getting the fixed revenue as part of that contract. But Greg, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. You know, I think the relationship with the Home Office is still very, very good. We're working, you know, very, very collaboratively with them. Talking about the additional CapEx, we've deployed most of the network now. We are working with the Home Office to identify any gaps in coverage. And, you know, I'm pleased to say that what we identified as part of our midterm plan, we've got the CapEx identified on that, and we've quantified that quite closely now. So I'm feeling quite confident over the next 12 months or so, we'll roll out any gaps in that coverage. But the majority of the CapEx is already in place.
Okay, and then Deutsche Telekom, Tim.
Yeah, sure. Good question, but I mean, just to pick up on the skills thing, as Mark mentioned, I mean, a lot of clearly we don't pay six-figure sums on the east coast of England, but what we do is try and create engaging and hugely, you know, important jobs that can excite people. And one of the ways in which we are getting that message out is by working very closely with things like the doctoral training centres around the UK. I think you know we've got very strong links with about 40-odd universities. We fund about 40 PhD students. We're also participating a major, I think the most significant player in something called the IET Diamond Scholar Scheme, which is essentially funding undergraduates, but obviously using it as a way of identifying superb talent at the undergraduate level and then encouraging them to come into work experience with us. Because we find the best way of getting people to come and work for us is to get them to come spend a little bit of time with us, one of our engineering centres, be it at Astral or be it one of the other centres around the UK. So, you know, lots of stuff. It's a really important point. We're leaning in very hard, and we are getting some, you know, some dividends. On the DT point, we do a lot of stuff with DT. So this usually manifests itself in research collaborations, which then rolls into co-work within international standards. So a lot of the work we've been doing on, I mean, the exam question that I think Howard positioned it as taking that sort of exponential growth in traffic and sort of trying to linearize it in terms of how we can respond to it. So a lot of the work we've done on coherent optical super channels and looking at defining the future technologies that allow us to deal with that capacity growth more gracefully is something we've done collaboratively with DT and others, because it is, of course, a problem that is generic. The work we've been doing on quantum is stuff that we've been working with them on, thinking through to not just what the technology can do, but what sort of standards, what sort of capabilities are going to be needed in the market to take this brilliant idea from the laboratory and actually into a really important exam question, solving an exam question within the real world. The work on GFAST, of course, the paper that we submitted to international standards bodies to shift the world in the way Howard described, that didn't just have BT's name on it, it had DT's name on it, and it had a range of other operators on there as well. So, you know, yes, I spent time over in Darmstadt, the Ipswich of Germany, you might think, maybe. But certainly we do a lot of close work with DT's lab, and it's, you know, it bears fruit for us in terms of us driving the global ecosystem.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. It's Paul Sidney, Credit Suisse. Just a couple of questions on 5G. There's still a huge amount of hype surrounding 5G. We talk about small sites, different frequency bands. But what does EE's 5G network look like when it's complete? How do you envisage it in terms of the number of cell sites, the mix of cell sites, frequencies you're using? And then second question, do you have any early data stats on 5G users versus 4G users? Is having 5G driving additional demand for data? Perhaps it's a little bit early, but just interesting if you've got any data points.
So I will answer the second question first. It is a bit early. We do have some data, and we're keeping it well and truly under wraps for now, being the only operator out there with that experience right now. On the first point, though, you know, I think we agree with you. I think, you know, there has been too much hype about 5G in the run-up to launches. You know, we looked at it, through a real sort of lens of return on investment, you know, and the network efficiency that we spoke about earlier would have us launch at scale probably in another 18 months. We then looked at the opportunity to charge customers a premium, particularly in consumer, by launching earlier. And you'll notice that the offer that we put out has a premium attached to it. So, you know, for us, there was very much a return on investment in launching when we did, and also because we had learned so much through being the first to 4G and our best network capability, that it made absolute sense to be the same with 5G. You know, the international triangle of use cases for 5G has three apexes, one of which is enhanced mobile broadband, which
you know, is in essence our first proposition. You know, you've seen, and Greg talked about an example of looking at low latency that we were doing with a hospital up in Birmingham. You'll see some other examples of that over the next actually few days of where we've been doing some more trial work. So our approach at the moment is to roll out 5G to the sites that are the busiest 4G sites. And so our 16 cities are the busiest 16 cities from a 4G point of view, and the sites that we're choosing in those locations are where most customers are using 4G. That's certainly our initial rollout this year. The next event really from a 5G point of view is will be a 5G iPhone. And we're all speculating as to when that might be. You know, our most likely view is September 2020, because obviously iPhones all come out in September. You know, so the second point we're looking at is what geographic penetration do we need in order to, you know, get a scale launch of the iPhone. And our medium-term plan has that as its basis option, and that we'll get to a, I'm not going to say the number, but we'll get to a, you know, a good geographic coverage scale in time for iPhone launch in September 2020. The other areas, and you know, as we launch 5G for the BT brand, and particularly for BT Enterprise later this year, the use cases there, which is campus networks, and Neil described some millimeter wave applications for that, but also some sub-6 applications for that. Looking at edge, multi-axis edge compute, and indoor coverage of 5G. One of the industry problems that we will lead in solving is, you know, do we all seamlessly stay on 5G as we move into a building, or do we seamlessly hand over to Wi-Fi 802.11ac or AX as we move into a building? And solving that problem is something that we're pushing the industry hard in the standards bodies to make that a great experience. So I think those are the areas. So, you know, we'll continue the macro rollout. Let's not forget now, you know, I don't know, eight years into 4G, we're at 85% geographic coverage. As of yet, right now, I would expect a similar trend on the rollout of 5G. You know, I don't see a big rush to go and equip our 18,500 macro sites with 5G necessarily any faster than we have with 4G. Now, new use cases may come along that will drive that, but we'll wait and see. It's still at the back here.
Hi, just staying on 5G, you show in the slides the number of very highly valued businesses that you've enabled through your 4G network. Do the economics change at all when you move to a 5G network in terms of what you might take from those businesses that you're enabling?
Yes, and that's the area that we are looking at the use cases of now. We've done quite a lot of research in use cases, both public sector and private sector. I think a combination of high bandwidth for enterprises with, you know, applying the smart capabilities in that's unique to their vertical sector, so whether it's automation, you know, manufacturing, is where I think there's a wave of 5G value that the whole industry is very excited about, but quite intangible in business case creation yet. I think we are quite far down that journey, and you know, we're working hard at some key UK partnerships that we want to put in, you know, to make concrete to then take those explorations further. So I think it's a great opportunity. It's still in that quite hard to pin the business case down.
Well, thanks, Stephen Howard at HSBC. About 8 questions or something. Start with 2. So the first is on the IT transformation. Like, what can possibly go wrong? I remember speaking to one of your UK hesitate to say, peers, rivals a few years ago. You know, what went wrong with previous IT transformation projects, I asked them. And they gave a very sensible set of explanations and told me about how they were going to avoid all those traps, but then they found a new bunch of other traps. And, you know, promptly had a bit of a disaster. So what's going to go wrong here? Something will go wrong. What's it going to be? I really struggle to have confidence that significant projects that use the dreaded transformation word in a business that is facing cost pressures, is under a lot of regulatory political scrutiny, I really struggle to have confidence that these will be managed effectively and without mishap. The other question is, I would like a bit more detail about the convergence thing. I mean, Howard, I think you just mentioned this sign-off issue, handover issue rather, taking 5G indoors. It would be interesting to know some of the specific technology standards you have in mind, because I wind up sometimes wondering whether I understand this field at all. If I look at slide 11, you've been talking about the benefits of convergence in terms of adding wireless capacity to wireline in order to boost your network speeds. You're also saying on this slide that the wireless capacity is, I think you said, an 80th of the fixed line. Right? How does it help to boost the fixed line capacity by an 80th? I mean, I would submit that if your wireline capacity actually needs a wireless boost, you have a big problem with your wireline capacity.
Okay, Rachel and I will do the first one, and then I'll cover on the second one, maybe with help from Neil. Okay, so IT transformations. I think your observation is interesting, and actually, in many cases, quite accurate. I have many colleagues who are current. I guess the phrase I've used in the past, maybe I shouldn't, are skeletons in the IT cupboard of CIOs who have taken on big, really challenging transformations and had problems. In almost every case, what they have attempted to do is build something brand new and then take large volumes of customers in the millions and migrate them from the existing into the brand new. We are not going to do that, is the first thing I would say. Because I agree with you, that is a road with many pitfalls that leads to many problems. So that's the first thing I would say is, we're looking at changing parts of our IT architecture, modernizing it, cloudifying it in a way that doesn't require large-scale migration of large numbers of customers. So that's one pitfall we'll avoid. Do you want to add to that, Rachel?
Sure. I think the second large pitfall I've always seen is the lack of business sponsorship. And through Neil's team that we've massively upskilled from an enterprise architecture perspective, we've been working very closely with the business to have them define and lead on the ambition around what the transformation should achieve, and also have personal sponsorship deep within the organization to ensure that we maintain momentum and we look at this from a business change perspective, not a systems change the business adopts. So the techniques I talked about, design thinking, really helped with that because it co-creates the ambition and the solutions with the actual business users and some actual customers to ensure that we deliver the right thing in the right way. And then thirdly, I think that one of the other areas most organizations fail at is failing to realize that the skills you need to infuse in the organization don't stop at technology's door. You have to refactor the ways of working of the entire organization. And so although we're leading it from within IT, much of what I talked about is actually pan-booty, making sure that all of our people can work in agile ways and adopt new tools and practices to give us that early insight into whether something's succeeding or failing, and we can take course-corrective action if we need to.
Okay, and then on your second question, I think, so the way I look at fixed mobile convergence, particularly around data as opposed to voice, is, Greg mentioned We've had some early examples of where we've used mobile essentially as a backup fix with our 4G Assure product. That's proved really popular with some enterprise customers, particularly at the SME end of the spectrum. We've got BT Plus product launched, which is essentially the same thing. It's giving you assurance of continuity of service. The piece about expanding capacity, I agree, in a
in a dense urban area with great super fast or ultra fast fixed coverage, the likelihood of needing mobile to supplement fixed, you know, is probably quite niche. However, if you just think about our mobile network, we have 5 separate frequency bands or carriers that we use for 4G. And the way, you know, the whole country, all 18,500 sites, starts with one carrier each. And then as usage grows, we add a second carrier, a third carrier, a fourth carrier, a fifth carrier. We have large parts of rural, suburban and rural UK where we've only got as far as 2 carriers on the mobile network. And we can satisfy the needs of customers there. In those instances, which often coincide with where there are longer loop lengths in the fixed network for VDSL, or it's not within the current Fibre Cities program, we do see that there is a real window of opportunity of augmenting your current either copper broadband or super fast broadband with actually a quite low cost to provide, because adding a carrier to one of our existing sites and using our spectrum assets is not a high cost. Providing that capability to a hybrid hub that takes mobile and fixed and converges it is a really important use case. As fiber then arrives, as ultra-fast arrives to those households, what will then happen is that that will be at the point where we're starting to refarm that 4G spectrum to 5G use cases, and then we'll effectively see much of that spectrum then go back to being macro outdoor usage. So we think we actually have quite a sort of real alignment of opportunity around convergence, which is augment fixed, fiber arrives, free up for reuse for 5G off the macro sites. And if we look at the most economic way of driving or of helping our customers through the usage curve, that's how we see that piece of it. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd add, so I tend to agree with your point. I think, you know, fiber is really the long-term future with mobile augmenting overall capacity. I think you're going to hear a lot about a technology called ATSSS, which is a technology that allows us to seamlessly migrate from fixed to mobile to Wi-Fi. And we, actually, with DT, have brought the Broadband Forum and 3GPP together to really bring fixed and mobile together in a much more converged and controlled way, so that when you move, you know, so that video that Greg showed, when you're on the move, you're not having to worry about turning the Wi-Fi on, banging your password in, waiting for the thing to refresh, that the whole network takes care of that. It's a completely new set of standards, bringing, you know, what was 2 very different technologies much more together. And we're pushing to get that into the next set of 5G releases because obviously we've got the assets that we can really leverage on that. So that's where I think, you know, it's that whole experience and way of using the network that's much more seamless that I think really drives the benefit between Wi-Fi, mobile, and fixed.
Okay, I think we've got time for 2 more questions. We've got 5 minutes left. So we're going to go here, please, first, and then over there.
Hi, thank you. It's Kiel from JP Morgan. It's just a one big picture question, linking a lot of things we've talked about together. You've talked a lot about the cost savings, efficiency gains that you can achieve from cloud, 5G, fiber, and things like that, and obviously that sounds very interesting. But I guess the kind of general pushback you get is those have been trends we've seen in the industry for a long time anyway, and the real problem is what you point to at the beginning, which is the revenue decline this industry suffering, which is your 2% CAGR or negative CAGR over the last 5 years. So I guess the question really is, when you think about the past and then looking forward to what you can learn from it, what can you do and what are you doing now to try and find and identify the opportunities that this new technology can drive and support? Because that's been the failing of 4G, that it was the tech companies that identified those and leveraged those. It wasn't the telco. So I guess the question is, number 1, what are you doing about that? And I guess secondly, when you think about the ecosystem in which you're trying to do that, you've got some very large tech companies with very deep pockets. How do you try and compete, and can you, or is it more about JVing, partnering with other players, because it's just a very hard space to try and identify these opportunities in?
Okay, so that be about three or four questions, but I'll give it a go. So the first one, which is, I mean, you are right that much of the cost-optimizing technologies we've talked about have been around for a while. That doesn't mean that telcos with the complexity and scale that we have deployed them all. So we see there's quite a lot of cost transformation road left in both our network and IT areas to drive down those journeys. And actually, you know, you're right. My industry generally here is a follower in this space, not a leader, which is actually good news because it means we're less likely to bang into some of the problems that were referenced over here as we look to take those capabilities. So I think, you know, there is much mileage left in cost transformation in our business. Second point is, you know, interestingly, you've heard Philip start to talk about this, which is, you know, what are the opportunities that we can look for that potentially, in at least first of all, in our UK marketplace, can potentially generate new sources of revenue. You know, we have a whole process running over the course of the next 9 to 12 months to work through that. We've contributed our thinking in there around those three extra areas of trust as a service, you know, analytics as a service and productivity as a service, because we think we know we have core competence to bring capabilities to life in those areas. We're also looking hard at security. We're looking at health. I do think that and then your final point, which is you're right, that ecosystem is dominated by you know, Western US companies that are generically called the FANGs. You know, and however, as the UK becomes, as the political environment in the UK changes over the next few months, I think that could absolutely create opportunities where we could do things for the nation and customers in the nation, which are unique and, you know, rely on our true local presence to create capability that can generate sources of income there, and that's what we're focused on looking for. And then final question, I think, is over here.
Hello, this is a much less big picture question than the previous one. Rupert Wood from Analysys Mason. As some of your international peers have already started talking about timelines for next generation fiber to the premises technologies, XGS or NG-PON2, what consideration are you giving to those new technologies for, especially in the context of 5G, front haul, mid haul, centralized RAN, cloud RAN technologies?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of, yeah, two questions in one there. So the first one, which is around next generation PON, you know, we have, you know, in the labs in Adastral, we have all of that capability. In terms of timelines for that, that's a question to address to Openreach, not to me. But, you know, the capability is there for that. It's about the right rollout plan for that. You know, in terms of sort of the next stages of that on how we use that for front haul, we participate in a lot of that, whether it's through NGMN, which is the sort of body of operators, whether it's through 3GPP standards or through actually some of the more disruptive bodies like the Telco Infra Project. C-RAN was sort of unique to Asia because it was very inefficient at using fiber as a way of connecting base stations to you know, to the remote radios. As that RAN's looking to be more virtualized, we do see opportunities for that. And so as we're looking at maybe extensions out into more rural mobile, that presents opportunities there. So they're all in the toolkit. It's just a matter of when the right economic time is to introduce them. Okay, with that, I'm going to thank you all for braving what for some of you was difficult train journeys here today. And thank you for your time. And hopefully we have succeeded in lifting the veil at least a little bit on what we do here in technology. Thank you.